We are grateful for our listeners who gave during WMNF Summer Membership Drive. You did well. However, we came up several $1,000s short of our goal. If you were out of town or somehow missed the drive, we still need your help in keeping independent community strong for you. Independent community radio strong for you, that is. Please call 813-213-238 or give online at WMNF.org. You can also call me right here in the studio at 813-239-9663, and I'll take your pledge. Thanks for making WMNF your free speech zone. I'm Duncan Strauss, really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll discuss orcas in the wild, orcas in captivity, particularly at SeaWorld, and more with David Kirby, author of an extraordinary new book, Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity. First, though, we're kicking off the show with an appropriate animal tune. This is Michael Gettle with Orcas here on Talking Animals. This is Michael Gettle with a piece called Orcas. An on-the-nose animal song leads us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name is Duncan Strauss, here with a program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, David Kirby, investigative journalist and New York Times best-selling author of Evidence of Harm and Animal Factory. His new book, Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales, is a sweeping, thorough examination of orcas in the wild, orcas in captivity, particularly at SeaWorld, and details the February 2010 attack that killed trainer Don Branchot, the circumstances leading up to that deadly incident, and numerous other trainer attacks at the Orlando Park and elsewhere. If I may editorialize for a moment, and who's going to stop me, really? This book represents an exhilarating journalistic achievement. The reporting is singularly deep and wide, the research meticulous, the storytelling as gripping as that of a great novel. So anyways, we'll discuss the book and many of the orca issues contained therein when David Kirby joins us in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the Comedy Corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune, and the winner will receive a copy of Death at SeaWorld. And we'll also offer you the opportunity to pledge for a pair of red-hot tickets to see Blondie and Devo at our wonderful event September 23rd at England Brothers Park, Pinellas Park. Be the first on your block to have these tickets. You can help WMNF, all for a $60 pledge. So, come on. That's what we say in the cliche biz, a win-win, or maybe a win-win-win. I'm not even sure. Stop me before I say win again. Right now, though, it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment, a look at items of interest in animal news as well as announcements of local events on the horizon, produced, as always, by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Reed News Department. Our first item, of course, we want to remind you about this cool WMNF event. WMNF is presenting the Tampa Bay Area Premiere of Veducated on August 15th at the Roosevelt 2.0 in Ybor City. Veducated is an award-winning feature-length documentary that tracks three meat-and-cheese-loving New Yorkers who agree to adopt a vegan diet for 6 weeks. From there, the film widens out to look at animal agriculture, factory farming-related issues, and more. But maintains a great tone, really light hand and nice humor. It's not preachy or shrill. It's fun and funny even at times. And anyway, so looking forward to this on August 15th. The Roosevelt 2.0 will provide vegan nibbles. You heard me. I said vegan nibbles. And also, in response to some inquiries, we will indeed offer it in a closed caption format, probably on a second screen at the Roosevelt 2.0. So we're happy to do that as well. And then the post-screening will have a panel discussion that will address Veducated and some of the issues raised by the film. So representing viewpoints across the omnivore to vegan continuum, the panelists slated to appear are Eve Prang Plews, nutritionist and host of WMNF's Alternative Health Program, Isabel Tossi, chief organizer of Tampa Bay Veg Fest, which this year will be October 13th at Cotenshobee, Fort Brooke Park. She's also a longtime vegan animal rights activist. Lee Flea Courtney, WNF music director and host of Monday's It's the Music. And a spoiler alert, underwent something of a transformation after seeing Veducated. You can find out more by attending the screening. And myself, Duncan Strauss, from, of course, from Talking Animals, will be round out the panel. So, $9 covers the whole shebang, right? The vegan nibbles, the screening, the panel discussion. So, anyways, go to WNF.org or call Miss Julie here at the station during business hours, 813-238-8001. Get your tickets. It's going to be a really cool evening, I think. So, anyways, as far as those tickets to Blondie and Evo, again, this event is September 23rd, England Brook... Okay, my handwritten notes are illegible. That's what's good about typing sometimes. That's what I say. Anyway, England Brothers Park and Pinellas Park, right. So, again, September 23rd, and Blondie and Devo on the show. So for a $60 pledge, we'll get you fixed up with great tickets for that. You can help WMNF. So, anyways... If you want to call here, 813-239-9663. We'll take your pledge when I can grab the phone. Or, of course, you can email dj at wmnf.org. Or you can just go to wmnf.org itself and go through the Talking Animals tip jar. Whatever's easiest for you, we're happy to oblige. On to animal news from the Los Angeles Times. A judge on Tuesday harshly criticized the Los Angeles Zoo for its care and housing of elephants and ordered changes to improve the animals' welfare, but also found that the treatment did not amount to abuse and the exhibit can remain open. Quote, this case raises the question of whether the recreational, perhaps educational needs of one intelligent mammal species outweigh the physical and emotional, if not survival needs, of another. Los Angeles County Superior Court Judge John L. Siegel wrote in his 56-page opinion, existing California law does not answer that question. In his ruling, Siegel ordered that elephants at the zoo's Elephants of Asia exhibit be exercised at least 2 hours a day and the soil be rototilled to lessen the impact on their joints. He also entered an injunction banning the use of certain disciplinary tools, including electric shock and a barbed stick known as a bull hook. Devices the zoo said it no longer uses. Siegel's decision was based on evidence presented during a closely watched 6-day trial last month, during which plaintiffs argued that conditions in the exhibit were inadequate, damaging, and abusive. They asked that the exhibit be closed and the elephants sent to a sanctuary. So we will continue to monitor this one, as we've been monitoring this next one for what seems like eons. This comes from the Toronto Star. Latest update there, Toronto Star's trio of aging African elephants doesn't have to start packing the trunks just yet for California's Performing Animal Welfare Society Sanctuary. They won't be leaving until September, says Julie Woodier of ZooCheck Canada, the local organization working on behalf of the PAWS sanctuary. The animals have been scheduled to leave in August after months of delays. City Council voted October 2011 that the animals be sent to the sanctuary. Quote, the heat is a big problem because they are in steel crates, said Woodier, adding that while the cargo aircraft will travel on is climate controlled, the summer heat while loading the animals could cause problems. There's no point in taking a risk for the sake of a month. But reports about a case of an Asian elephant with tuberculosis at PAWS has some pachyderm lovers concerned that PAWS isn't the best place for Toronto's three African elephants. Two small groups of picketers took up spots outside the zoo Sunday, both sides insisting they have the animals' welfare at heart. And on it seems to go over there. Locally, back to the local scene here, this Saturday, July 29th, there's a vegan bake sale presented by Cat Crusaders, and this will benefit spay, neuter, and medical care for feral cats. So again, Saturday, July 29th from noon to 6 p.m. at the Body Shop at the Shops at Wiregrass Mall. And there'll be kitten adoptions, gift basket raffle, discounts on Body Shop purchases, lots and lots of great vegan baked goods and more. So you can find out more by going to Cat Crusaders online. And under the category of if you see something, say something, this comes from the paper over on my side of the state, the Palm Beach Post, and I was alerted to this by my ever-vigilant mother-in-law who wanted to be sure that I saw this. So this is headlined, Witnesses Man Threw His Dog. It's from Dateline Tequesta. Tequesta man is facing felony animal cruelty charges after witnesses told police they saw him pick up his dog and slam it to the ground repeatedly Friday night. Village police arrested William Ramsey Hayes Friday night. He was taken to the Palm Beach County Jail and held there until he was released Saturday afternoon after posting $500 bond. Hayes faces one count of animal cruelty, village police said. Several witnesses on Friday night reported seeing a man near Seabrook Road and Ridgewood Circle lift his young Labrador Retriever above his head, said Lieutenant Jason Turner, a police spokesman. The witnesses told police the man then slammed the animal to the ground repeatedly until a witness confronted him. The man then fled the area with the dog. One witness was on the phone calling 911 while another followed the suspect to his residence about a half mile away, Turner said. Police later arrested Hayes. An officer assessed the dog while arresting Hayes and noticed the animal had trouble sitting. Turner said the dog then fell over and unsuccessfully tried to get back up. Hayes helped the animal stand again. The dog was taken by Palm Beach County Animal Care and Control and is expected to undergo further evaluation. But again, as my mother-in-law noted, very big shout-out to people who not only called 911, but this other guy who, I think it was a guy, who followed this this man to his house. So, again, classic case, really, of if you see something, say something, no? All right, looking ahead a little bit, on Saturday, August 11th, there'll be an event called Dog Days of Summer. You can bring your best friend to Artist Fair Gallery and Gift Shop, Tarpon Springs, August 11th from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. There will be treats for both four-legged and two-legged visitors, and professional photographer J. David Wright will be taking photographs of humans and their dogs at an incredibly reasonable price from noon to 2, and there's other canine art and all kinds of cool things to see and do. So that's coming up, again, August 11th at the Artist Fair Gallery and Gift Shop. So I think we will try to come back to some of these remaining things later if we have time. But right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy, as always. Wanted to find one at least somewhat relevant for the forthcoming Whale Discussion with David Kirby. This is Eddie Izzard with a piece called Talk to the Animals on today's Comedy Corner. Now, Talking Animals.
But, you know, whales, they're intelligent. They do whale song. We don't know what it means, but I think that whales are traveling at 78. They're traveling at 78 speed, and if we take them up to 45 speed, we'll find they're actually going, I love you, baby. I love you, baby. What another baby. Question me, love me. Yeah, they're DJs, you see. DJs of the sea. Because sound travels well in water, and they need a big PA to be a DJ, but they've got their whole bodies. Yeah, it works, doesn't it? This next song is going out to all the goldfish down by the Azores. I love you, baby. So they're intelligent, and dolphins, they're intelligent, because we all saw the documentary Flipper. Well, dolphins came up going, what's that? What's that, Flip? Chiang Kai-shek is having trouble. Mao Zedong has taken over mainland China. Chiang Kai-shek has retired to Taiwan with some of his followers. Where they will have a complete disregard for international copyright rules. Is that what you're saying, Flip, or do you want fish? Because every episode of Flipper, he'd say the same thing. Always having a problem. What's that? What? A boy trapped in a well, trapped in the water. Three boys fell out of a ship, a small ship, a big ship. Two syllables. Big ship, small ship. Sounds like the deep. Bit like the deep, bit of shark, jaws, da da da, da like that. What? Gone with the wind. Okay. And they were all like that. There was Skippy. Yeah. What's that, Skip? A boy trapped, drowning in a desert. Drowning in a desert, in a desert. Ill. He's in a sandy place. He's ill. He's got a bad leg. What? Gone with the wind? And Lassie as well. What? You know, all Lassie, Flippy, Skippy, all that E sound. Except for Flipper.
All right. That was Eddie Izzard with a piece called Talk to the Animals, taken from his album Circle. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. We did have a caller call while we're listening to the comedy piece point out that this Saturday is not July 29th, it's July 28th. But the rest of the information about the vegan bake sale holds true, and thank you for correcting that. So, it's nearly time to speak with today's guest, David Kirby. As I touched on earlier, David is an investigative journalist and author, most recently of Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales. His new book delves deeply and widely into all things orca, how orcas live in the wild, how orcas live in captivity, and how those things are in direct, sometimes disastrous conflict. Perhaps most notably when Don Brownshow, a trainer at the Orlando SeaWorld, was attacked and killed by an orca named Tilikum in February of 2010. That might be the most high-profile trainer attack by a killer whale, but as David's reporting here indicates, it's also just one of literally countless attacks over the years and arguably all but inevitable given the circumstances involved. So with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome David Kirby to Talking Animals. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. I'm very excited that it's out, and I'm really thrilled with the reception it's getting, and I think it's making people think about issues they probably never thought about before.
Well, yeah, and I've been sort of touting to anyone who will listen, and even some who won't, that to me it's just like an exhilarating journalistic achievement. I mean, just as a media junkie and a journalism nerd, I'm just sort of blown away by the reporting, the research, the storytelling, and as I said to someone, or maybe I posted this somewhere, I mean, it's nearly 500 pages with the index and your incredibly extensive footnoting and stuff, but I was sorry to see it end. You know, so that's a pretty good sign. Yeah.
That's a great compliment.
Yeah. So how long did you spend on the book from start to finish?
I did it in relatively quick time. I was surprised I was able to. Let me think. I think I got the contract in February of 2011, and I started writing that August, and I turned in the book this January.
Holy. So a year. Wow. Yeah. Again, only someone who has read the book will be as astonished maybe as I am, just because, again, it just, as I mentioned before, but it's just that incredible reporting and research, and obviously you followed, you know, all kinds of stories, and the book therefore follows all kinds of storylines, some which we'll get into in a moment. But boy, obviously you work fast and well, so that's even more of a big heads up to you and thumbs up. So anyway, there's a bunch of stuff I want to discuss about the book, but I guess in a way I feel compelled to sort of start out by addressing the orca in the room, or tank as it were. I mean, your book is like a dark thriller where you know in the opening scene or even before who done it. But one of the triumphs of the book is that by the time we hit page, I guess, 300 or so, where you've created sort of the ultimate in context for the moment by moment description of that attack by Tillicum that killed Don Brancho. So, maybe you could just talk. I mean, among my responses when I got there is like, gosh, it's not unfortunately surprising that that happened. What is surprising is that he hadn't killed more than the two before Don, and that there weren't more deaths at SeaWorld by other whales. So maybe you could just sort of talk about, you know, Tillicum and sort of that whole, you know, because obviously the book's, you know, pivots around that, even though there's much, much else that's to this.
Yeah, I do believe that the killing of Don Brancho, and I do believe it was a killing, was sort of the culmination of years and years of trying to find a way to have people and killer whales in a pool at the same time and have the people get out unscathed. SeaWorld has worked very hard on their safety protocols and implemented a whole raft of measures to try to prevent this kind of thing from happening. But I think the lesson is, even if 99.9% of the time you can keep an animal under control, on that one incident where you can, a killer whale is going to do whatever it wants to do, and it won't stop doing it until it decides it wants to stop.
Yeah.
And, of course, Tillicum just kept going even after Don was dead. He paraded her body around the pool and wouldn't relinquish it. I sort of made Tillicum a character in the book, if
yeah.
you will. He can't talk, but I thought it was extremely important to view this story from his point of view as well,
yeah.
to the extent we can get inside an animal's mind. And that's why I dedicated a chapter to the actual capture of Tillicum, ripped away from his mother's side when he was maybe 2 or 3 years old in Iceland, sent to Canada, and then eventually ending up in SeaWorld, where he was put in tanks with older, much more dominant female orcas who basically beat the crap out of him. And in a small pool, you have nowhere to run. So he, you know, suffered a lot of abuse from other whales and killed somebody in Canada and then was shipped to SeaWorld, and he killed somebody else who snuck into his pool one night, and then, of course, he killed Don.
Yeah.
I think there's a message there.
Well, I think there's a few messages, David. I mean, maybe let's just back up a little bit, because to me there's, you know, two or three at least major things that just sort of outlining the way you did what happened. I mean, let's go back actually to as you say, kind of the capture of Tillicum, because one of the things that's really clear, that you make really clear in the book, and even those of us who thought, hey, I know a fair amount about orcas and how they work and how they function, it's like, well, actually, it turns out I had a lot to learn. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how almost singularly matriarchal orca families are, and therefore when he was, you know, Tillicum in this case was taken from his mother, you know, never great weather, all kinds of captive animals, but this seems particularly crucial from the sort of ramifications and consequences of, you know, catching a baby orca, Tillicum in this case, consigning him to a tank, and then again, the other whales that he's with. But just, let's just start with what normally would happen if he wasn't grabbed and taken from his mother then.
Sure, and again, I thought it was really important to describe the natural history and sociobiology and behaviors of these animals in the wild to understand why captivity is so unsuitable for them. And one major reason is the family bonds. Killer whales have perhaps the strongest family bonds of any animal on the planet, including humans. In the resident community, the whales that live in the Pacific Northwest, some of them, the males in particular stay with their mother for life, often remaining within one body length of her. Males are subdominant in this society. They depend on females for status, for protection, for being part of the herd or the group. And if you remove a male from his mother, it's probably going to be extremely traumatic for both of them. Now, I should point out that Tilikum is an Icelandic orca, and they have not been studied to the extent that whales in the Pacific Northwest have been studied. So we don't know for sure if Icelandic males stay with their mother for life, but there's evidence to suggest that their culture is at least somewhat similar to the resident communities here on the West Coast.
Sure. So again, so you've got Tilikum taken from his mother at that age, and then, as you say, put in tanks then with females who, as you colorfully put it, kind of beat the crap out of them. So again, maybe let's focus on that phase, because to me, I mean, you know, again, just one of the things that's I think just really you know, fascinating and great about the way you presented all this is that I was just sort of finishing the book when, unfortunately, the Aurora massacre happened. And, of course, there was all this immediate rampant speculation about the shooter's state of mind and stuff, why he did it. But meanwhile, I was at the same time thinking, well, you know, I wouldn't pretend to know anything more than all the cable speculators or bloggers, or whatever, about that. But I know kind of pretty well why Tilikum did what he did, because it seemed like they almost brewed up a recipe for an orca to go nuts.
I think captivity has taken its toll on him and some of the other animals at SeaWorld. Not necessarily every killer whale at SeaWorld, but several of them have acted in very neurotic ways, in very unnatural ways, in very aggressive ways. You may know there's a video making the rounds today that I actually released. I put it on Huffington Post yesterday, and it's getting a lot of attention. That's attacked by another killer whale named Kasaka. She grabbed her trainer and pulled him to the bottom of the pool several times. He's lucky to be alive. The video is really quite scary. But she was performing in a Shamu show in San Diego, and her calf was in the back pool calling for her. And when that had happened in the past, she would go off behavior, and I think this time she snapped. And she grabbed her trainer of many years, with whom she had a very good relationship, a strong bond, and almost killed him. Now, I don't think she was trying to kill him. I think she was trying to say, hey, this is wrong. My child needs me. You're not letting me go back to comfort my child.
Yeah.
And you're making me perform in a show. I'm going to grab you, and I'm going to hurt you.
Yeah.
Because I'm not happy.
Upset. Right. Well, that's the thing. And even there's a couple things. One is that, you know, what you really make clear, too, is that SeaWorld and others, but yeah, obviously the focus is the SeaWorld parks, you know, kind of move these whales around just randomly, like they're just sort of game board pieces without really any concern for what sort of dynamic there is, or even if they've been torn from their mother in captivity or at the park, you know, what's going to happen when they just get, you know, transferred or sold off or loaned to another park totally elsewhere?
Yeah, the moving around like chess pieces is problematic for many reasons. One, that the physical act of moving a several ton animal that belongs in the water is very stressful on the animal. They spend hours in these tiny little boxes, basically, of ice water. As they're flown about the world and flown about the country. But you mentioned the separation of calves from their mothers. I think that's no less traumatic at SeaWorld than it would be in the ocean. I described several occasions when calves were removed from their mother, and it was horrible for both of them. The mothers would sort of go into a what seems to be a grieving period.
Yeah.
And then the other problem is when you start introducing whales from different societies into the same pool and try to create these artificial pods with whales that don't even have the same dialect, that can't communicate with each other, that have different DNA, that eat different types of food, that behave differently, and then you expect them to all be one happy family. There's a lot of aggression between the whales as well as between whales and trainers.
Yeah.
And it leads to things like interbreeding, so you can breed a Pacific resident whale with an Icelandic whale, or perhaps even they bred what are called transient orcas, which some scientists believe are actually a different species than resident orcas. So for SeaWorld to say they're doing conservation work, they're not. They're creating these sort of I don't want to say mutant, but completely unnatural DNA lines.
Yeah.
And then there's also inbreeding. Tilikum is the father and grandfather of many, many whales at SeaWorld. They're now being bred with each other. And in one case, SeaWorld allowed a young male to impregnate his own mother.
Yeah.
And that calf, Milani, in SeaWorld, she's not growing as large as her tank mates. And she's quite likely the only directly inbred killer whale in the world. That is as taboo in orca society as it is in our own society.
Mm-hmm.
SeaWorld never should have allowed that to happen.
Yeah. Well, let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with investigative journalist and author David Kirby, whose new book is Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity. If you'd like to ask David a question, offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So back sort of periodically, at least to Tilikum, just because that's obviously an important thread to the book, and therefore probably to today's conversation. But the other thing that I think I had a sense of, but I guess I didn't have the full sense of, is how incredibly smart and complex orcas are. So again, thinking about Tilikum, who is clearly bored. He's deprived. His day-to-day existence, especially in recent years, is woefully solitary, kind of unstimulating. And I'm sort of haunted by images that you described of various people, whether it's Dr. Rose or other people from different organizations, or just, you know, people interested, going to visit SeaWorld and just watching Tilikum, seeing Tilikum sort of in a back tank, just floating by himself in a back pool. And it's
it's got to be incredibly boring for them. I just got back from the San Juan Islands. I was with Dr. Naomi Rose from the Humane Society. She's the lead character in my book and one of the leading killer whale experts in the world. I was with three of the four former trainers that are in my book, Jeff Ventry, Carol Ray, and Sam Berg. And we went out to see the whales in the wild, which I've done several times now. And they are so smart. They are so charismatic. You mentioned their intelligence. Their brains are four times larger than our brains. They have been evolving for about 5 million years. As the brain grows, it starts to fold upon itself because the skull can only get so big. Well, if you see a killer whale brain, it is so crenellated, it's so folded in upon itself that there's lots of surface area for that brain to work. They can do things that we just can't even comprehend. Their communication, their echolocation, their ability to navigate and find prey and keep in touch with each other is just uncanny.
Yeah.
If you go, and again, I mean, I cannot encourage people enough to go to a place like San Juan Island where you just pull over on the side of the road and walk to the cliff for free and watch these animals rolling around in the kelp beds, and the kids are, the children, the human children watching this, are squealing in joy in this absolutely, you know, stunningly beautiful environment. And one day I was watching the whales, and they were playing and rolling around. There must have been 30 of them in this bay. And all of a sudden, they all went underwater, and then they were gone. They disappeared.
Hmm.
Obviously, somebody, probably the grandmother, the matriarch, said, "We're out of here. We're moving on."
Sure.
She gave some kind of signal, some kind of communication. These animals knew, okay, we're going.
Yeah. And when grandma talks, they all listen. Right?
You better listen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's take a caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with David Kirby.
Hello.
Hi, it's you.
Hiya. I had two questions, actually, for our expert today. I mean, I just learned is it true that is the deal with the males not separating from their mother exclusive to orca? And why don't the females do it?
Two terrific questions. And as much as I like being called an expert, I'm not. I'm a journalist. I'm not a scientist. So I want to make that clear. I do not have a degree in studying these animals. But
you know more than me, so you're an expert as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, thank you. It is not unique to orcas, but it is fairly rare. It's fairly unusual in advanced mammal species. species. It's called philopatry, which means love of your native habitat, love of your patria. Usually among males in mammal societies, it's the male who disperses. It's very disruptive to have a bunch of testosterone-charged young guys hanging out with the herd or the pod or whatever. They cause stress and disruption. They fight with each other. So typically it's the males that disperse and the females who stay closer to their mom. In orca society, that is reversed. The females don't leave completely. Once they start having their own children, they will stay in the matriline, but they won't be as physically close to their mother all the time the way the males are. And the way it works out for the males is pretty interesting. One reason they're sort of allowed to be kept around is because they will babysit their younger brothers and sisters when their mother wants to go off to rest or socialize with her friends or her other female companions. The older male will then babysit the children. So what's in it for the older male? Well, when that mother goes to socialize with other females, he sort of gets entree for sexual liaisons, and he may go off for a day or two for a little rendezvous with one of his mom's friends or the daughter of one of his moms. I don't want to use the word friends, but one of the animals she knows, and then come back to mom. So it kind of evolution somehow worked out this arrangement where it allowed these males to stay with the pod. Not only are they not disruptive, but they're actually very beneficial.
Thanks so much for your call.
Excellent. Thank you.
So, David, let's just because I know we're going to nearly have time to shoehorn in all the stuff I was hoping to talk about, but let's talk a little bit more specifically about SeaWorld, and especially, again, since this is all sort of revolving as it should around Tilikum, let's talk a little bit about sort of what happened in the wake of the Tilikum killing of Don Brasho, and especially the OSHA side of things, maybe either starting with the news of last week on the OSHA verdict or and maybe work backwards, or maybe you can actually provide us a bit of history here, what the rulings have been, you know, and what SeaWorld has done along the way.
Yeah.
And what the monumental implications are.
Sure. I think it's easier to explain in chronological order.
Yeah.
Tilikum killed Don Brasho in February of 2010. That set off an immediate investigation by OSHA, led by Laura Padgett, inspector out of Tampa, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And she did an amazing job of documenting safety lapses in previous incidents and training procedures. And OSHA made the decision to slap SeaWorld with the maximum fine and a willful violation and a series of abatements to get trainers, either keep them out of the water or figure out a way to keep them as safe in the water as they would be out of the water, which is a almost impossible task. SeaWorld decided to sue OSHA to overturn the violation and get rid of those abatements because SeaWorld wants to get trainers back in the water ASAP. I attended that trial, as did lots of people in Orlando last fall, and basically they lost. The citation was lowered, the violation from willful to serious, but serious is still serious.
Mm-hmm.
But the abatements remain. So SeaWorld really wants to get rid of those, and they really want to get this violation cleared off their record. So they applied, they asked for an appeal with a commission at the Labor Department in Washington. That commission just very recently rejected their appeal. So for now, the judge's ruling stands. SeaWorld has about another month or so to decide if they're going to appeal in the federal court system, in the circuit court. I think they will. But my understanding is, in the meantime, they still have to certify any day now that they have met the OSHA requirements and have put in abatements that will protect the trainers, such as fast-rising false bottoms of the pools, spare air system, you know, emergency oxygen supply for the
sure.
trainers, and other technology. My sense is that OSHA will not approve those measures,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to have another standoff very soon.
So David, with that kind of the way it seems to be shaping up here, and at the moment, at least on paper and beyond, SeaWorld seems to really be hobbled by the OSHA rulings. So is an extension of that conceivably that the killer whale shows no longer, you know, will make sense, will be the moneymaker drawing card for SeaWorld that it has been all these years?
Well, you know, SeaWorld just posted record profits last year. By the way, they did not pay a penny in state or federal taxes on that windfall. They sent it all to their parent company, the Blackstone Group in New York. They wrote it all off as depreciation and loan repayments, and Blackstone didn't pay a penny on that income. So there's hundreds of millions of dollars tax-free. But I think it also points to the fact that, you know, SeaWorld can get by without water work. They claim they're doing better than ever without trainers in the water. So I don't know why they're so desperate to get them back in, except that it's a much better show. Let's face it, if you're going to see an orca show, you want to see people swimming with the whales because, frankly, it's quite spectacular.
Yeah. So your sense then, based on that and based on record-setting profits, that even if they have to kind of live with the abatements, which I'm sure like they've done every other step of the way, they'll fight tooth and nail, but if they just fall short, they'll just make do with what those restrictions are.
Yeah, what was that Pretender song, Stop Your Sobbing?
Right.
You gotta stop sobbing. What's your problem, SeaWorld? You're making record profits.
Yeah.
And your trainers are safe, so why can't you just proceed?
Sure. And so another thing kind of on a related note, by the way, this is my guest is investigative journalist and author David Kirby, whose new book, just out last week, in fact, is Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in the Captivity. I have just maybe another couple minutes here, but if you'd like to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org, we invite you to do so. So one thing that this kind of all, this last part of this conversation reminds me of is the whole whistleblower thing and yet another sort of kind of thing that almost reminded me of sort of a film, you know, sort of thriller where you think, okay, hey, now the man's going to really get theirs and be revealed, but these two people are coming forward. And then right when the pivotal scene unfolds, boom, nothing, because they retract their statements, they bail out. I mean, is that just the power and or the money of SeaWorld just at work? Because at least one of those in particular, I was like kind of jaw-dropping by the time I read how that played out.
Very jaw-dropping, yeah. After Don was killed, two fairly high-level former executives came forward. That's what got me interested in this. One alleged obstruction of justice and blocking the OSHA investigation in the Branchell killing, and the other one backed up what the first one had said, and she also made allegations of very serious sexual harassment at Shamu Stadium and racial discrimination in hiring. Now, I was able to confirm the discrimination allegations with the Labor Department. That actually did happen. But both of these women filed signed, sworn affidavits with OSHA. One of them went on Larry King Live and Good Morning America and publicly made these allegations about obstruction. The other one I interviewed twice, and I have her on tape, and I have her affidavit, and I see no reason why she would just make this stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
I did confirm that the racial hiring problem did indeed happen. I think they're both very credible people.
Yeah.
But when push came to shove, they both recanted every single word.
Yeah, SeaWorld got to them in some fashion, clearly. Yeah.
One would assume.
Yeah. You know, and as one of those goes, you know, it's a measure, too, of how dark and dysfunctional the SeaWorld culture is that some, you know, as the sexual improprieties emerge, I mean, those almost seem incidental to the overall saga.
I know. In any other company, that would be a major scandal.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a very dark blemish. SeaWorld has other things to contend with. And,
yeah,
of course, SeaWorld, you know, I asked them about these allegations, and they did not deny it. They said that this was a former employee, but they didn't say that what she said was untrue until she recanted.
Yeah.
And then they said, well, she's taking it all back. Her own attorney didn't know that she was going to recant. She went into her deposition and just started saying, I take it back.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think you even sketch that scene, and you think everybody's sitting down, and here's what's going to happen. And that guy, the lawyer, the way you sort of present it, seemed as shocked as anybody. Yeah. So, well, David, I think we are just about sort of reached the end of our time here, but I really appreciate you making the time to talk to us today. Again, we've been speaking with David Kirby. His brand new book is Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity. There's a website, deathatseaworld.com. There's a Facebook page specifically devoted to this, Facebook Death at SeaWorld /Death at SeaWorld. And, David, again, obviously I'm a fan of the book, and there's just so many other things that we didn't even have a chance to cover, but perhaps folks will go out and get a copy and read those things themselves. So.
Okay, maybe I can come back on sometime. We can continue the conversation.
Absolutely. Would love that. So thank you again, and good luck.
Thanks, Duncan.
All right, take care. Bye. All right. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WNRF member to win, and there'll be a prize. A copy of Death at SeaWorld, the new book we've just been discussing with author David Kirby. To the first person who calls in the correct title of this animal tune, to 813-239-9663. This is a nod to the gentleman who called in last week during an interview with Roberto Martin. And instead of having a question or comment for Roberto, made an unrelated request. So this is sort of a tip of the hat to him. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. WNF presents the Tampa Bay Area premiere of Veggiecated, a documentary which tracks three dyed-in-the-wool meat and cheese-eating New Yorkers as they go vegan for 6 weeks.
Veggiecated has a light humorous touch. It's not ham-fisted or tofu-fisted. But by the end, the movie has given us plenty to chew on, and with that in mind, we're also presenting a panel discussion after the screening representing viewpoints across the omnivore to vegan continuum.
Eve Prang Plews, nutritionist and host of Alternative Health here on WNF. Isabel Tossi, chief organizer of Tampa Bay Veg Fest, Lee, WMNF music director, and who underwent a conversion after seeing Veggiecated, and me, Duncan Strauss, host of WMNF's Talking Animals.
Tickets are just $9 at WMNF.org or call 813-238-8001. That's Veggiecated, August 15th at the Roosevelt 2.0.
All right, we have some folks who may know if they can name that animal tune. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
I think it was Pigs by Pink Floyd, wasn't it?
It was what by Pink Floyd?
Pigs.
Pigs? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Oh, shoot. So close, but not quite right. I'll give you one more chance because we're really cool here. So one more chance to guess if it's not Pigs, it might be what?
Flying? Oh, I can't remember. Damn it, man. I know
it's
off the animals, too. Oh, man.
Right. Okay. No
problem.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks for calling. All right. We'll maybe take one of the others in a moment. But, a guy called in last week, and in the middle of the interview said he had a request for Pink Floyd, something from Pink Floyd's Animals. So there you go, in a way, sir. All right. A couple more animal news items while we have another minute or two left for that. So, this came by way of the Associated Press. The parent company of one of Metro Phoenix's major mall operators is phasing out pet stores in favor of animal adoption centers. The Santa Monica, California-based Macerich, which owns the Westcor malls in the Phoenix area, said it will not renew leases for any pet stores that sell live animals. The policy adopted last year could benefit rescued animals and the agencies that tend to them. Quote, our focus is now directed to working with local pet rescue organizations in our communities and pet rescue retailers to save the needs of our shoppers, said Melissa Rupp, assistant marketing manager at the Macerich-owned Santan Village in Gilbert. The policy reflects a national shift in public opinion regarding pet buying. The Arizona Public reported Monday that the Humane Society of the United States and the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals have investigated puppy mills and commercial dog breeding operations that they say raise animals in squalor. So, more of this going on. Good thing. All right, we got some more guests. So I guess we'll take another. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal, Tim?
Yeah, great show. Is it sheep?
It is sheep. You are correct, right, sir. What is your first name?
David.
David, all right, David, I'll come back and get your information, and I'll send you off then a copy of David Kirby's new book, Death at SeaWorld, Shamu and the Dark Side of Killer Whales in Captivity. Thanks for playing. Congratulations.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, folks, we do have a winner. So, also, let's see, another thing I thought was interesting. Animal advocates are celebrating the passage of two laws this past week in New York that move closer to protecting the health and safety of animals. One involves animals for sale from pet dealers, but not the one I just read. And the second addresses dog fighting. So, the first bill was signed by the governor July 18th and creates new requirements for pet dealers that sell dogs and cats directly to the public. And so prior to the passage of this bill, people breeding and selling dogs were not required to have a plan for veterinary care and were not required to exercise animals in their care. The animals could be kept in a crate just big enough for them to lie down. Many of these kennels were purposely set up so no human contact was necessary. Now that will change. Goes on from there. And the second law signed by the governor this week prohibits people from owning, possessing, selling, transferring, or manufacturing paraphernalia to be used in animal fighting. There are already laws in the books that prohibit people from fighting animals, but many thought laws could use some strengthening by passing a new law that also prohibits the equipment dog fighters use to train and fight animals. It's now more difficult for criminals to engage in these horrific blood sports. So, good work, New York. And, again, just a little cautionary tale about how vigilant we all have to be. This came from the Sacramento Bee, even though it deals with a animal shelter in northeast Georgia. Been accused of charging people money to spare dogs and cats from being euthanized, then killing those animals anyway. WAGA-TV reports that the Boggs Mountain Humane Shelter in Tigard offered a lucky dog and kitten program by paying a fee. People were giving up pets, thought they were guaranteeing their animals would not be killed and covering their adoption costs for the next owner. But former shelter employee Lynn Cousins said some of those animals were euthanized. Cousins said the shelter sent letters and emails to people claiming euthanized pets had been adopted. Cousins said she was asked to resign after contacting the TV station. This investigation continues. So, and for those who really like to plan ahead, this came up on the air a while back, but our friends at Bach Gardens have a Dog Day of Summer event coming up September 8th, and it'll be at the gardens, and supporting the Humane Society of Polk County, and dog health, safety, and adoption information will be available, along with special friends who need a good home, and there'll be an Ask a Vet thing, training specialists, microchipping, doggy boutique items for sale, grooming tips from vendors, and more. So, anyways, Bach Tower Gardens. For more information, check their website. All right, I think that brings us pretty much to the end of our thing here. And so we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, August 1st, when our guest will be Diane Wygant, an expert on raw food diets for dogs and cats, who will discuss and clarify information about raw food, whole prey, and how these things can impact the health of those pets. As a prelude, in fact, to a seminar she'll be offering in St. Petersburg on August 4th. Website for more information about her and the seminar is rawfeddogsandcats.com. I hope you'll join me next week for that. Also, visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby Basalis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. And if you would like more talk and information, just switch to our digital channel, 88.5 HD3, The Tom Hartman Show. Starts up at noon at WMNF.org/HD. On the other hand, stay tuned if you like music. Wonderful music for the equally wonderful Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. And he's going to have a great, great show. He's going to be listening, previewing several tracks from Modest Yahoo's new CD, Spark Seeker, and featuring some of the artists of the Anti-Warped, and also be hearing from Citizen Cope, new stuff, Rufus Rainwright, Lumineers. So it's all coming up momentarily on WNF with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. So we're closing out today's show with an animal tune, yet another one that's orca-specific, and this is a band actually called The Killer Whales, with a song entitled Orca's Revenge, taking us up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa, Bradenton, St. Petersburg, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks for listening. Take care. We'll see you soon.
From NPR News and Washington.